Part 4. And let my cry come unto thee. Chapter 1. In the breathing dark of his quiet office, Kinderman brooded above his desk. He adjusted the desk lamp beam a fraction. Below him were records, transcripts, exhibits, police files, crime lab reports, scribbled notes. In a pensive mood, he had carefully fashioned them into a collage in the shape of a rose, as if to belie the ugly conclusion to which they had led him, that he could not accept. Engstrom was innocent. At the time of Denning's death, he had been visiting his daughter, supplying her with money for the purchase of drugs. He had lied about his whereabouts that night in order to protect her and to shield her mother, who believed Elvira to be dead and past all harm and degradation. It was not from Carl that Kinderman had learned this. On the night of their encounter in Elvira's hallway, the houseman had kept obdurately silent. It was only when Kinderman apprised the daughter of her father's involvement in the Dennings case that she volunteered the truth. There were witnesses to confirm it. Engstrom was innocent and silent concerning events that involved the McNeils. Kinderman frowned at the collage. Something was wrong with the composition. He shifted a petal point, the corners of a deposition, a trifle lower and to the right. Roses, Elvira. He had warned her grimly that failure to check herself into a clinic within 2 weeks would result in his dogging her trail with warrants until he had the evidence to effect her arrest. Yet he did not believe she would go. There were times when he stared at the law unblinkingly, as he would the noonday sun, in the hope it would temporarily blind him while some quarry made its escape. Engstrom was innocent. What remained? Gently wheezing, the detective shifted his weight and, closing his eyes, he imagined he was soaking in a sudsy hot bath. Mental closeout sale, he bannered himself. Moving to new conclusions, everything must go. A pause, and then, positively, he added sternly. And with that, the detective opened his eyes and examined afresh the bewildering data. Item: the death of Director Burke Denning seemed somehow linked to the desecrations at Holy Trinity. Both involved witchcraft, and the unknown desecrator could easily be Denning's murderer. Item: an expert on witchcraft, a Jesuit priest, had been seen making visits to the home of the McNeils. Item: the typewritten sheet of paper containing the text of the blasphemous altar card discovered at Holy Trinity had been checked for latent fingerprints. Impressions had been found on both sides. Some of them had been made by Damien Karras. But still another set had found that, from their size, were adjudged to be those of a person with very small hands, quite possibly a child. Item: the typing on the altar card had been analyzed and compared with the typed impressions on the unfinished letter that Sharon Spencer had pulled from her typewriter, crumpled up, tossed at a waste paper basket, missing it while Kinderman had been questioning Chris. He had picked it up and smuggled it out of the house. The typing on this letter and the typing on the altar card sheet had been done on the same machine. According to the report, however, the touch of the typist differed. The person who had typed the blasphemous text had a touch far heavier than Sharon Spencer's. Since the typing of the former, moreover, had not been hunt and peck, but skillfully accomplished, it suggested that the unknown typist of the altar card text was a person of extraordinary strength. Item. Burke Dennings, if his death was not an accident, had been killed by a person of extraordinary strength. Item. Engstrom was no longer a suspect. Item. A check of domestic airline reservations disclosed that Chris McNeil had taken her daughter to Dayton, Ohio. Kinderman had known that the daughter was ill and was being taken to a clinic, but the clinic in Dayton would have to be Barringer. Kinderman had checked, and the clinic confirmed that the daughter had been in for observation. Though the clinic refused to state the nature of the illness, it was obviously a serious mental disorder. Item. Serious mental disorders at times caused extraordinary strength. Kinderman sighed, closed his eyes, and shook his head. He was back to the same conclusion. Then he opened his eyes and stared at the center of the paper rose, a faded old copy of a national news magazine. On the cover were Chris and Reagan. He studied the daughter, the sweet, freckled face, and the ribbon ponytails, the missing front tooth and the grin. He looked out a window into darkness, where a drizzling rain had begun to fall. He went down to the garage, got into the unmarked black sedan, and then drove through rain-slick, shining streets to Georgetown, where he parked on the eastern side of Prospect Street, and for minutes sat silently staring up at Reagan's window. Should he knock at the door and demand to see her? Lowering his head, he rubbed at his brow. William F. Kinderman, you are sick, he thought. You are ill. Go home, take medicine, sleep, get better. He looked up at the window again and ruefully shook his head. To this place had his haunted logic led him. He shifted his gaze as a cab pulled up to the house. He started his engine and turned on the windshield wipers in time to see a tall old man stepping out of the cab. He paid the driver, then turned and stood motionless under a misty street lamp's glow, staring up at a window of the house like a melancholy traveler frozen in time. As the cab pulled away and rounded the corner of 36th Street, Kinderman quickly pulled out to follow. As he turned the corner, he blinked his headlights, signaling the cab to stop, while inside the McNeil house at that moment, Karis and Carl were pinning Reagan's emaciated arms, while Sharon injected her with Librium, bringing the total amount injected in the last 2 hours to 400 milligrams, a dosage Karis knew that was staggering. But after a lull of many hours, the demonic personality had awakened in a fit of fury so frenzied that Reagan's debilitated system could not for very long endure it. Karis was exhausted. After his visit to the chancery office that morning, he returned to the house to tell Chris what had happened, and after setting up an intravenous feeding for Reagan, he'd gone back to his room in the Jesuit residence hall, where he fell face down and limp onto his bed, and instantly into a profound and deep sleep. But after barely 2 hours, the strident ringing of his telephone wrenched him awake. Sharon. Reagan was still unconscious, and her pulse had been gradually slipping lower. Karis had then rushed to the house with his medical bag and pinched Reagan's Achilles tendon, looking for reaction to pain. There was none. He pressed down hard on one of her fingernails. Again, there was no reaction. Karis grew alarmed. Though he knew that in hysteria, and in certain states of trance, there was sometimes an insensitivity to pain, he now feared coma, a state from which Reagan might so very easily slip into death. He checked her blood pressure, 90 over 60. Then a pulse rate, 60. He had waited in the room then and checked her again every 15 minutes for an hour and a half before he was satisfied that both her blood pressure and pulse rate had stabilized, meaning Reagan was not in shock, but rather in a state of stupor. Sharon was instructed to continue to check Reagan's pulse every hour. Then Karras had returned to his room and to sleep. But now again, a ringing telephone awakened him. The exorcist, the Chancery office told him, would be Lancaster Merrin, with Karras to assist. The news had stunned him. Merrin, the philosopher paleontologist, the soaring, staggering intellect. His books had stirred ferment in the church, for they interpreted his faith in terms of matter that was still evolving and destined to be spirit, that at the end of time would join with Christ, the Omega Point. Karras had immediately telephoned Chris to give her the news, but found that she'd heard from the bishop directly that Merrin would arrive the next day. I told the bishop he could stay at the house, Chris said. It'll just be a day or so, won't it? Before answering, Karras had paused, then said quietly, I don't know. And then pausing again, he said, you mustn't expect too much. If it works, you mean, Chris had answered. Her tone had been subdued. I didn't mean to imply that it wouldn't, the priest reassured her. I just meant that it might take time. Oh, how long? Well, it varies. Karras knew that an exorcism could take weeks, even months, knew that frequently it failed altogether. He expected the latter, expected that the burden, barring cure through suggestion, would fall once again, and at the last, upon him. It can take a few days or weeks, he'd then told her, and she'd answered him numbly. How long has she got, Father Karras? When he'd hung up the phone, Karras felt heavy, tormented. Stretched out on his bed, he thought of Merrin. Merrin! An excitement and a hope had seeped into him, although a sinking disquiet had followed. He himself had been the natural choice for exorcist, and yet the bishop had passed him over. Why? Because Merrin had done this before? As he'd closed his eyes, Karras recalled that exorcists were selected on the basis of piety and high moral qualities. That a passage in the Gospel of Matthew related that Christ, when asked by his disciples the cause of their failure in an effort at exorcism, had answered, because of your little faith. The provincial had known about his problem, as had also Tom Birmingham, the Georgetown president. Had either of them mentioned it to the bishop? Here Karras had turned over on his bed, despondent, feeling somehow unworthy, incompetent, rejected. It stung. Unreasonably, it stung. Then finally sleep flowed into his emptiness, filling in the niches and the cracks in his heart. Then again the waking ring of his telephone, Chris calling to inform him of Reagan's sudden frenzy. Back at the house, he checked Reagan's pulse. It was strong. He gave a Librium, then gave it again, and again. Finally, he made his way to the kitchen, slumping down at the breakfast table with Chris. She was reading a book, one of Merrin's, that she'd ordered delivered to the house. Boy, way over my head, she told Karras softly. And yet she looked touched and deeply moved. But, Father, there's some of it so beautiful, so great. She flipped through pages to a passage she had marked and handed the book across the table to Karras. Now take a look at this. Have you ever read this? I don't know, let me see. Karras took the book and began to read. We have familiar experience of the order, the constancy, the perpetual renovation of the material world which surrounds us. Frail and transitory as is every part of it, restless and migratory as are its elements, still it abides. It is bound together by a law of permanence, and though it is ever dying, it is ever coming to life again. This illusion does but give birth to fresh modes of organization, and one death is the parent of a thousand lives. Each hour as it comes is but a testimony how fleeting, yet how secure, how certain, is the great whole. It is like an image on the waters, which is ever the same, though the waters ever flow. The sun sinks to rise again. The day is swallowed up in the gloom of night, to be born out of it as fresh as if it had never been quenched. Spring passes into summer, and through summer and autumn into winter, only the more surely, by its own ultimate return, to triumph over that grave towards which it resolutely hastened from its first hour. We mourn the blossoms of May because they are to wither, but we know that May is one day to have its revenge upon November by the revolution of that solemn circle which never stops, which teaches us in our height of hope ever to be sober, and in our depth of desolation never to despair. Yes, it's beautiful, Kara said softly. And as he poured a cup of coffee for himself, the raging of the demon from upstairs grew louder.
Bastard! Scum! Pious hypocrite!
She used to put a rose on my plate. In the morning, before I'd go to work, Chris said distantly. Karis looked up with a question in his eyes, and Chris answered it. Yeah, Reagan, she told him. She looked down. Yeah, that's right. I forget. Forget what? I forget that you've never met her. She blew her nose and dabbed at her eyes. You want some brandy in that coffee? No, no thanks. Coffee's flat. Chris whispered tremulously. I think I'll get some brandy. Excuse me. She stood up and left the kitchen. Kara sat alone and sipped bleakly at his coffee. He felt warm in the sweater that he wore beneath his cassock, felt weak in his failure to have given Chris comfort. Then a memory of childhood shimmered up sadly, a memory of Reggie, his mongrel dog, growing skeletal and dazed in a box in a run-down tenement apartment. Reggie shivering with fever and vomiting while Karis tried covering him with towels, tried to make him drink warm milk, until a neighbor came by, looked at Reggie, and shaking his head said, "Your dog has distemper. He needed shots right away." Then dismissal from school one afternoon, out into the street, in columns of twos to the corner, his mother there to meet him, unexpected. Why was she there? Looking sad. And then pressing a shiny half-dollar piece into his hand. Elation. So much money. Then her voice, soft and tender. Reggie die. He looked down at the steaming, bitter blackness in his cup and felt his hands bare of comfort or of cure. Your dog needed shots right away. Karis immediately got up and returned to Reagan's bedroom, where he held her while Sharon administered a Librium injection that brought the total dosage up to 500 milligrams. As Sharon swabbed the needle puncture, preparing to slap a Band-Aid onto it, Karis was staring down at Reagan in puzzlement. or the frenzied obscenities spewing from her mouth seemed directed at no one in the room, but rather at someone unseen, someone not present. He dismissed it. "I'll be back," he told Sharon. Concerned about Chris, Karis went down to the kitchen, where again he found her sitting alone at the table. She was pouring brandy into her coffee. "You sure you wouldn't like some, Father?" she asked him. Shaking his head, he came over to the table, where he sat down wearily and lowered his face into his hands on propped elbows, heard the porcelain clicks of a spoon stirring coffee. "Have you talked to her father?" he asked. "Yes, he called," Chris said. "He wanted to talk to Rags." "And what did you tell him?" "I told him she was out at a party." Silence. Karis heard no more clicks. He looked up and saw Chris staring up at the ceiling. And then he noticed it too. The shouting of obscenities above had ceased. "I guess the Librium took hold at last," he said gratefully. Chiming of the doorbell, Karis glanced toward the sound, then at Chris, who met his look of surmise with a questioning, apprehensive lifting of an eyebrow. "Kinderman?" Seconds ticked by as they sat and listened. No one was coming to answer. Willie was resting in her room, and Sharon and Carl were still upstairs. Tense, Chris abruptly got up from the table and went to the living room where, kneeling on a sofa, she parted a curtain and peered furtively through the window at her caller. "No, not Kinderman, thank God." It was a tall old man in a threadbare black raincoat and black felt hat, his head bowed patiently in the rain, as at his side he was gripping a black valise. For an instant a silvery buckle gleamed in street lamp glow as the bag shifted slightly in his grip. "Who on earth is that?" Another doorbell chime. Puzzled, Chris got down off the sofa and walked to the entry hall. She opened the front door slightly, squinting out into darkness as a fine mist of rain brushed across her eyes. The man's hat brim obscured his face. Yes, hello? Can I help you?" "Mrs. McNeil," came a voice from the shadows, gentle and refined, yet as full as a harvest. As the stranger reached up to remove his hat, Chris was nodding her head, and then suddenly she was looking into eyes that overwhelmed her, that shone with intelligence and kindly understanding, with serenity that poured from them into her being like the waters of a warm and healing river whose source was both in him and yet somehow beyond him, whose flow was contained and yet headlong and endless. "I'm Father Lancaster Merrin," he said. For a moment, Chris stared blankly at the lean and ascetic face, at the sculptured cheekbones, polished like soapstone. Then quickly she flung wide the door. "Oh, my gosh. Oh, please come in. Come on in. Honestly, I don't know where my..." He entered and she closed the door. "I mean, I didn't expect you until tomorrow," Chris finished. "Yes, I know," she heard him saying. As she turned around to face him, she saw him standing with his head angled sideways, glancing upward, as if he were listening. No, more like feeling, she thought, for some presence out of sight, for some distant vibration that was known and familiar. Puzzled, Chris studied him. His skin seemed weathered by a sun that shone elsewhere, somewhere remote from her time and her place. "What's he doing?" "Can I take that bag for you, Father?" "Oh, it's all right," he said softly. "Still feeling, still probing. It's like part of my arm. Very old, very battered." He looked down with a warm, tired smile in his eyes. "I'm accustomed to the weight. Is Father Karis here?" "Yes, yes, he is. He's in the kitchen. Have you had any dinner, Father Merrin?" Merrin did not answer. Instead, he flicked his glance upward at the sound of a door being opened. Yes, I had some on the train. Are you sure you wouldn't like something else? No answer. Then the sound of the door being closed. Merrin's warm gaze came back to Chris. No, thank you, he said. You're very kind. Still flustered. Gee, all of this rain, Chris babbled. If I'd known you were coming, I could have met you at the station. It's all right. Did you have to wait long for a cab? A few minutes. I'd take that, Father. Carl. He descended the stairs very quickly, and now slipped the bag from the priest's easy grip and took it down the hall. We put a bed in the study for you, Father. Chris was fidgeting. It's really very comfortable, and I thought you'd like the privacy. Come on, I'll show you where it is. She started moving, then stopped. Would you like to say hello to Father Karras? I should like to see your daughter first. Right now, you mean, Father? Chris said doubtfully. Merrin glanced upward again, with that air of distant attentiveness. Yes. Now, he said. I think now. Gee, I'm sure she's asleep. I think not. Well, if... Suddenly, Chris flinched at a sound from above, at the voice of the demon, booming and yet muffled, croaking like an amplified premature burial. It called out, Merrin! And then the massive and shiveringly hollow jolt of a single sledgehammer blow against the bedroom wall. God almighty! Chris breathed out as she clutched the pale hand against her chest. Stunned, she looked at Merrin. The priest hadn't moved. He was still staring upward, intense and yet serene, and in his eyes there was not even a hint of surprise. It was more, Chris thought, like recognition. Another blow shook the walls.
Merrin!
The Jesuit moved slowly forward, oblivious of Chris, who was gaping in wonder, of Carl stepping lithe and incredulous from the study, of Karras emerging bewildered from the kitchen while the nightmarish poundings and croakings continued. Merrin went calmly up the staircase, a slender hand like alabaster sliding upward on the banister. Karras came up beside Chris, and together they watched from below as Merrin entered Reagan's bedroom and closed the door behind him. For a time there was silence. Then abruptly the demon laughed hideously, and Merrin swiftly exited the room, closed the door, then moved quickly down the hall, while behind him the bedroom door opened again, and Sharon poked her head out, staring after him with an odd expression on her face. Merrin descended the staircase rapidly and put out his hand to the waiting Karras. Father Karras. Hello, Father. Merrin had clasped Karras's hand in both of his. He was squeezing it, searching the younger priest's face with a look of gravity and concern, while upstairs their hideous laughter turned to vicious obscenities directed at Merrin. You look terribly tired, Merrin said. Are you tired? No. Good. Do you have your raincoat here with you? No, I don't. Well, then here, take mine, said the gray-haired Jesuit, unbuttoning the rain-sprinkled coat. I should like you to go to the residence, Damien, and gather up a cassock for myself, two surplices, a purple stole, some holy water, and two copies of the Roman ritual, the large one. He handed his raincoat to the puzzled Karras. I believe we should begin.
Karras frowned. You mean now, right away?
Yes, I think so.
Don't you want to hear the background of the case first?
Why?
Karras realized that he had no answer. He averted his gaze from those disconcerting eyes.
Right, Father, he said.
He was slipping on the raincoat and turning away.
I'll go and get them.
Carl made a dash across the room, got ahead of Karras, and pulled the front door open for him. They exchanged brief glances, and then Karras stepped out into the rainy night. Merrin glanced back to Chris.
I should have asked you. You don't mind if we begin right away?
She'd been watching him, glowing with relief at the sense of decision and direction and command sweeping into the house like sun-drenched day. "No, I'm glad," she said gratefully. "Well, you must be so tired, Father Marin." The old priest saw her anxious gaze flicking upward toward the raging of the demon. "Would you like a cup of coffee?" she was asking in a voice that was faintly pleading. "It's hot and fresh made. Wouldn't you like some?" Marin saw the hands lightly clasping and unclasping the deep caverns of her eyes. "Yes, I would," he said warmly. "Thank you." Something heavy had been gently brushed aside, told to wait. "If you're sure it's no trouble." Chris led him to the kitchen, and soon he was leaning against the stove with a mug of black coffee in his hands. Chris picked up a liquor bottle. "You want some brandy in it, Father?" she asked him. Marin bent his head and looked down into his coffee mug without expression. "Well, the doctors say I shouldn't," he said. "But thank God my will is weak." Chris blinked and stared blankly, unsure of his meaning, until she saw the smile in his eyes as he lifted his head and held out his mug. "Yes, thank you, I will." With a smile, Chris poured the liquor. "What a lovely name you have," Marin told her as she did so. "Chris MacNeil. It's not a stage name?" Trickling brandy into her coffee, Chris shook her head. "No, I'm really not Sadie Glutz." "Thank God for that," murmured Marin with lowered eyes. With a gentle, warm smile, Chris sat down. "And what's Lancaster, Father? It's so unusual. Were you named after someone?" "I think perhaps a cargo ship," Marin murmured as he stared off absently. Lifting the coffee mug to his lips, he sipped, then reflected. "Or a bridge, yes. I suppose it was a bridge." Turning his gaze to Chris, he looked ruefully amused. "But now, Damien," he said. "Ah, how I wish I had a name like that. So lovely."
"What does that come from, Father?" "Damien was the name of a priest who devoted his life to taking care of the lepers on the island of Molokai. He finally caught the disease himself." Marin looked aside. "Lovely name," he said again. "I believe that with a first name like Damien, I might even be content with the last name, Glutz." Chris chuckled. She unwound, felt easier. And for minutes she and Marin spoke of homely things, little things. Finally, Sharon appeared in the kitchen, and only then did Marin move to leave. It was as if he had been waiting for her arrival, for immediately he carried his mug to the sink, rinsed it out, and placed it carefully in the dish rack. "That was good, and that was just what I wanted," he said. Chris got up and said, "I'll take you to your room, Father." Marin thanked her and followed her to the door of the study, where she told him, "If there's anything you need, Father, just let me know." He put his hand on her shoulder, and as he squeezed it lightly and reassuringly, Chris felt the warmth and the power flowing into her, as well as a feeling of peace and an odd sense of something that felt like... like what, she wondered. Safety? Yes. Yes, something like that. "You're very kind, Father," she said. Her eyes smiled. He said, "Thank you." He removed his hand, and as he watched her walk away, a sudden tightening of pain seemed to clutch at his face. He entered the study and closed the door. From a pocket of his trousers, he slipped out a tin marked Bayer aspirin, opened it, extracted a nitroglycerin pill, and placed it carefully under his tongue. Entering the kitchen, Chris paused by the door and looked over at Sharon. She was standing by the stove, the palm of her hand against the percolator, as she waited for the coffee to reheat. Looking troubled, she was staring into space. Concerned, Chris walked over to her and said softly, "Hey, honey, why don't you get yourself a little bit of rest?" For a moment, no response. Then Sharon turned and stared blankly at Chris. "I'm sorry.
Did you say something? Chris studied the tightness in her face, the distant look. What happened up there, Sharon? She asked. Happened where? When Father Merrin walked into Reagan's bedroom. Oh. Yes. Slightly frowning, Sharon shifted her faraway gaze to a point in space between doubt and remembrance. Yeah. It was funny. Funny? Strange. They only... Sharon paused. Well, they only just stared at each other for a while, and then Reagan... that thing. It said... Said what? It said, this time you're going to lose. Chris stared at her, waiting. And then? Well, that was it, Sharon answered. He turned around and walked out of the room. And how did he look? Chris asked her. Funny. Oh, Christ, Sharon, think of some other word. Chris snapped and was about to say something else when she noticed that Sharon had angled her head up and a little to the side, abstracted, as if she were listening. Following her gaze, Chris heard it too. The silence. The sudden cessation of the raging of the demon. Yet something more, something else. And growing. The women flicked sidelong stares at each other. You feel it too? Sharon asked. Chris nodded. Something in the house. A tension. A gradual pulsing, thickening of the air, like opposing energy slowly building. The lilting of the door chimes sounded unreal. Sharon turned away. I'll get it, Chris. She walked to the entry hall and opened the door. It was Karras. He was carrying a cardboard laundry box. Father Merrin's in the study, Sharon told him. Thanks. Karras moved quickly to the study, tapped lightly and cursorily at the door, and then entered with the box. I'm sorry, Father, he was saying. I had a little. Karras stopped short. Merrin, in trousers and T-shirt, was kneeling in prayer beside the rented bed, his forehead bent low to his tightly clasped hands. And for a moment, Karras stood rooted, as if he had casually rounded a corner and suddenly encountered his boyhood self with an altar boy's cassock draped over an arm and hurrying by without a glance of recognition. Karras shifted his eyes to the open laundry box, to the speckles of rain on starch. He moved to the sofa, where he soundlessly laid out the contents of the box, and when he'd finished, he took off the raincoat and draped it carefully over a chair. Glancing back toward Merrin, he saw the priest blessing himself, and he hastily looked away. He reached down for the larger of the white cotton surplices and had begun to put it on over his cassock when he heard Merrin rising and coming toward him. Tugging down his surplice, Karras turned to face him as the old priest stopped in front of the sofa, his eyes brushing tenderly over the contents of the laundry box. Karras reached for a sweater. I thought you might wear this under your cassock, Father, he said as he handed it over. A room gets extremely cold at times. Looking down at the sweater, Merrin touched it with his fingertips. That was thoughtful of you, Damien. Thank you. Karras picked up Merrin's cassock from the sofa, and as he watched him pull the sweater down over his head, only then, and very suddenly, while watching this homely, prosaic action, did he fully feel the staggering impact of the man, of the moment, of a thickening stillness in the house, crushing down on him, choking off breath and his sense of a world that was solid and real. He came back to full awareness with the feeling of the cassock being tugged from his hands. Merrin, he was slipping it on. You're familiar with the rules concerning exorcism, Damien? I am, Father. Merrin began buttoning up the cassock. Now, especially important is the warning to avoid conversations with the demon. The demon, thought Karras. He'd said it so matter-of-factly. It jarred him. We may ask what is relevant, Merrin continued, but anything beyond that is dangerous, extremely. He lifted the surplice from Karras's hands and began to slip it over the cassock. Especially do not listen to anything he says. The demon is a liar. He will lie to confuse us, but he will also mix lies with the truth to attack us. The attack is psychological, Damien, and powerful. Do not listen. Remember that. Do not listen. As Karras handed him the stove, the exorcist added, Is there anything at all you would like to ask me now, Damien? Karras shook his head. No, but I think it might be helpful if I gave you some background on the different personalities that Reagan has manifested. So far, there seem to be three. While slipping the stole around his shoulders, Merrin said quietly, There is only one. Then he reached for the copies of the Roman ritual and gave one to Karras. We will skip the litany of the saints, Damien. You have the holy water? Karras slipped a slender cork-tipped vial from his pocket. Merrin took it, then nodded serenely toward the door. If you will lead, please, Damien. Upstairs, by the door to Reagan's bedroom, Sharon and Chris stood waiting, tense, bundled in heavy sweaters and jackets. They turned at the sound of a door coming open and looked below to see Merrin, with Karras behind him, approaching the staircase in solemn procession. How striking they look, Chris thought. Merrin so tall, and Karras with the dark of that rock-chipped face above the innocent altar boy white of the surplice. She watched them steadily ascending the stairs, and although her reason said they had no unearthly powers, still she felt deeply and strangely moved as something whispered to her soul that perhaps they did. She felt her heart begin to beat faster. At the door of the room, the Jesuit stopped. Karras frowned at the sweater and jacket Chris wore. You're coming in? You think I shouldn't? Oh, please don't, Karras urged her. Don't. You'd be making a mistake. Chris turned questioningly to Merrin. Father Karras knows best, said the exorcist quietly. Chris looked to Karras again, dropped her head. Okay. Okay. She leaned her back against the wall. I'll wait out here. Oh, what is your daughter's middle name? Merrin asked. It's Teresa. What a lovely name, the old priest said warmly. He held Chris's gaze for a moment, reassuringly, and when he turned his head and looked at the door to Reagan's bedroom, Chris again felt that tension, that thickening of coiled darkness behind it, in the bedroom, beyond that door. Merrin nodded. All right, he said softly. Karras opened the door and almost reeled back from the blast of stench and icy cold. In a corner of the room, bundled up in a faded green sheepskin hunting jacket, Carl sat huddled in a chair. He turned expectantly to Karras, who had quickly flicked his glance to the demon in the bed. Its gleaming eyes stared beyond him to the hall. They were fixed on Merrin. Karras moved to the foot of the bed while Merrin, tall and erect, walked slowly to the side where he stopped and stared down into hate. And now a smothering stillness hung over the room. Then Reagan licked a wolfish, blackened tongue across her cracked and swollen lips. It sounded like a hand smoothing crumpled parchment.
Well, proud scum, the demonic voice croaked. At last, at last you've come.
The old priest lifted his hand and traced the sign of the cross above the bed, and then repeated the gesture toward all in the room. Turning back, he plucked the cap from the vial of holy water.
Ah, yes, the holy urine now, the demonic voice rasped. The semen of the saints! Merrin lifted up the vial, and the demonic face grew livid and contorted as the voice seethed. Oh, will you, bastard? Will you? Merrin started shooting holy water sprinkles, and the demon jerked its head up, the mouth and the neck muscles trembling with rage. Yes, sprinkle. Sprinkle, Merrin. Drench us. Drown us in your sweat. Your sweat is sanctified, Saint Merrin. Bend and fart out clouds of incense. Bend and show us the holy rump that we may worship and adore it, Merrin. Kiss it. Make. Be silent. The words were flung forth like thunderbolts. Karras flinched and jerked his head around in wonder at Merrin, now staring commandingly at Regan. And the demon was silent, was returning his stare. But the eyes were now hesitant, blinking, wary. Merrin capped the holy water vial routinely and returned it to Karras. The psychiatrist slipped it into his pocket and watched as Merrin kneeled down beside the bed and closed his eyes in murmured prayer. Our Father, he began. Regan spat and hit Merrin in the face with a yellowish glob of mucus. It oozed slowly down the exorcist's cheek. Thy kingdom come. His head still bowed, Merrin continued the prayer without a pause, while his hand plucked a handkerchief out of his pocket and then hurriedly wiped away the spittle. And lead us not into temptation, he ended mildly. But deliver us from evil, responded Karras. He looked up briefly. Regan's eyes were rolling upward into their sockets until only the white of the slayer was exposed. Karras felt uneasy. He felt something in the room congealing. He returned to his text to follow Merrin's prayer. God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, I appeal to your holy name, humbly begging your kindness that you may graciously grant me help against this unclean spirit now tormenting this creature of yours through Christ our Lord. Amen, responded Karras. Now Merrin stood up and prayed reverently. God, Creator and defender of the human race, look down in pity on this your servant, Regan Teresa MacNeil, now trapped in the coils of man's ancient enemy, sworn foe of our race who... Karras glanced up as he heard Regan hissing, saw her sitting erect with the whites of her eyes exposed, while her tongue flicked in and out rapidly, her head weaving slowly back and forth like a cobra's, and once again he had that feeling of disquiet. He looked down at his text. Save your servant, prayed Merrin, standing and reading from the ritual. Oh, trust in you, my God, answered Karras. Let her find a new lord, a fortified tower, in the face of the enemy. As Merrin continued with the next line, let the enemy have no power over her, Karras heard a gasp from Sharon behind him, and turning quickly around, he saw her looking stupefied at the bed. Puzzled, he looked back and was electrified. The front of the bed was rising up off the floor. Karras stared incredulously, transfixed. 4 inches, half a foot, then the back legs began to come up. Gott in Himmel, Karl whispered in fear. But Karras did not hear him or see him make the sign of the cross on himself as the back of the bed lifted level with the front. It's not happening, he thought. The bed drifted upward another foot and then hovered there, bobbing and listing gently, as if it were floating on a stagnant lake. Father Karras, Regan undulating and hissing. Father Karras? Karras turned. The exorcist was eyeing him serenely and now motioned his head toward the copy of the ritual in Karras's hands. The response, please, Damien. Karras looked blank and uncomprehending, unaware that Sharon had run out of the room. "Let the enemy have no power over her," Merrin repeated. Hastily, Karis glanced back at the text, and with a pounding heart breathed out the response, "And the son of iniquity be powerless to harm her." "Lord, hear my prayer," continued Merrin, "and let my cry come unto thee. The Lord be with you, and with your spirit." Merrin embarked upon a lengthy prayer, and Karis again returned his gaze to the bed, to his hopes of his God and the supernatural hovering low in the empty air. An elation thrilled up through him. "It's there. There it is, right in front of me." He looked around at the sound of the door coming open and Sharon rushing in with Chris, who stopped, unbelieving, and gasped, "Jesus Christ! Almighty Father, everlasting God." The exorcist reached up his hand in a workaday manner and traced the sign of the cross, unhurriedly, 3 times on Reagan's brow, while continuing to read from the text of the ritual. "Who sent your only begotten Son into the world to crush that roaring lion?" The hissing ceased, and from the taut stretched O of Reagan's mouth came the nerve-shredding lowing of a steer. "Snatch from ruination and from the clutches of the noonday devil this human being made in your image and..." The lowing grew louder, tearing at flesh and shivering through bone. "God and Lord of all creation," Merrin routinely reached up his hand and pressed the portion of the stole to Reagan's neck while continuing to pray, "by whose might Satan was made to fall from heaven like lightning, strike terror into the beast, now laying waste your vineyard." The bellowing ceased, and at first there ensued a ringing silence. And then a thick and putrid greenish vomit began to pump from Reagan's mouth in slow and regular spurts that oozed over her lip and flowed in thin waves onto Merrin's hand. But he did not move it. "Let your mighty hand cast out this cruel demon from Reagan Teresa McNeil, who..." Karis was dimly aware of a door being opened, of Chris bolting from the room. "Drive out this persecutor of the innocent!" The bed began to rock lazily, then to pitch, and then suddenly it was violently dipping and yawing, and with the vomit still pumping from Reagan's mouth, Merrin calmly made adjustments and kept the stole firmly to her neck. "Fill your servants with courage to manfully oppose that reprobate dragon, lest he despise those who put their trust in you." Abruptly the movement subsided, and as Karis watched mesmerized, the bed drifted feather-like and slowly to the floor, where it settled on the rug with a cushioned thud. "Lord, grant that this..." Numb, Karis shifted his gaze. Merrin's hand. He could not see it. It was buried under mounded, steaming vomit. "Damien?" Karis glanced up. "Lord, hear my prayer," said the exorcist gently. Karis turned. "And let my cry come unto thee." Merrin lifted off the stole, took a slight step backward, and then jolted the room with the lash of his voice as he commanded,
"I cast you out, unclean spirit, along with every power of the enemy, every specter from hell, every savage companion."
Merrin's hand at his side dripped vomit to the rug.
"It is Christ who commands you, who once stilled the wind and the sea and the storm, who..."
Reagan stopped vomiting and sat silent and unmoving, the whites of her eyes gleaming balefully at Merrin. From the foot of the bed, Karis watched her intently as his shock and excitement began to fade, as his mind began feverishly to thresh, to poke its fingers unbidden, compulsively, deep into corners of logical doubt. Poltergeist, psychokinetic action, adolescent tensions and mind-directed force. He frowned as he remembered something. He moved to the side of the bed, leaned over, reached down to grasp Reagan's wrist, and found what he'd feared. Like the shaman in Siberia, Reagan's pulse was racing at an unbelievable speed. The fact drained him suddenly of sun. And glancing at his watch, Karras counted the heartbeats now, like arguments against his life.
It is he who commands you, he who flung you headlong from the heights of heaven.
Meron's powerful adjuration pounded off the rim of Karras' consciousness in resonant, inexorable blows as the pulse came faster now, and faster. Karras looked at Reagan, still silent, unmoving. Into icy air, thin mists of vapor wafted from the vomit like a reeking offering. Then the hair on Karras' arms began prickling up as, with nightmare slowness, a fraction at a time, Reagan's head was turning, swiveling like a mannequin's, and creaking with the sound of some rusted mechanism, until the dread and glaring whites of those ghastly eyes were fixed on his.
And therefore tremble in fear now, Satan?
The head turned slowly back toward Meron.
You corrupter of justice, you begetter of death. You betrayer of the nations, you robber of life!
Karras glanced warily around as the lights in the room began flickering and dimming, and then faded to an eerie, pulsing amber. Karras shivered. The room was getting even colder.
You prince of murderers, you inventor of every obscenity, you enemy of the human race!
A muffled pounding jolted the room. Then another, then steadily shuddering through the walls, through the floor, through the ceiling, splintering and throbbing at a ponderous rate like the beating of a heart that was massive and diseased.
Depart, you monster! Your place is in solitude. Your abode is in a nest of vipers. Get down and crawl with them. It is God himself who commands you. The blood of...
The poundings grew louder. Began to come ominously faster and faster.
I adjure you, ancient serpent,
and faster.
By the judge of the living and the dead, by your creator, by the creator of all the universe, too.
Sharon cried out, pressing her fists against her ears as the poundings grew deafening, and now suddenly accelerated and leaped to a terrifying tempo. Reagan's pulse was astonishing. It hammered at a speed too rapid to gauge. Across the bed, Meron reached out calmly and with the end of his thumb traced the sign of the cross on Reagan's vomit-covered chest. The words of his prayer were swallowed up in the poundings. Karras felt the pulse rate suddenly drop, and as Meron prayed and traced the sign of the cross on Reagan's brow, the nightmarish poundings abruptly ceased.
O God of heaven and earth, God of the angels and archangels,
Karras could now hear Meron praying as the pulse kept dropping, dropping.
Prideful bastard, Meron! Scum! You will lose! She will die! The pig will die!
The flickering haze had grown gradually brighter, and the demon had returned to rage hatefully at Meron.
Profligate peacock, ancient heretic who dares to believe that the universe will one day become Christ? I adjure you, turn and look on me. Yes, look on me, you scum.
The demon jerked forward and spat in Meron's face, croaking afterward.
Thus does your master cure the blind.
God and Lord of all creation, prayed Meron, reaching placidly for his handkerchief and wiping away the spittle.
Now follow his teaching, Meron. Do it. Put your sanctified cock in the piglet's mouth and cleanse it. Swab it with that wrinkled relic, and she'll be cured, Saint Marin. Yes, a miracle!
Deliver this servant.
Hypocrite! You care nothing at all for the pig. You care nothing! You have made her a contest between us.
I humbly...
Liar! Lying bastard!
Tell us, where is your humility, Marin? In the desert? In the ruins? In the tombs where you fled to escape your fellow man? To escape from your inferiors? From the halt and the lame of mind? Do you speak to men, you pious vomit? Deliver.
Your abode is in a nest of peacocks, Marin. Your place is within yourself. Go back to the mountaintop and speak to your only equal.
Marin continued with the prayers unheeding as the torrent of abuse raged on.
Do you hunger, Saint Marin? Here, I give you both nectar and ambrosia. I give to you the daily bread of your god, croaked the demon mockingly as Reagan excreted diuretically. For this is my body. Now consecrate that, Saint Marin.
Repelled, Karras focused his attention on the text as Marin read a passage from Saint Luke. My name is Legion, answered the man, for many demons had entered into him, and they begged Jesus not to command them to depart into the abyss. Now a herd of swine was there, feeding on the mountainside, and the demons kept entreating Jesus to let them enter into them, and he gave them leave. And the demons came out from the man and entered into the swine, and the herd rushed down the cliff and into the lake and were drowned.
Willie, I bring you good news, croaked the demon.
Karras glanced up and saw Willie near the door, stopping short with an armload of towels and sheets.
I bring you tidings of redemption, Ned gloated. Elvira is alive! She lives!
Willie stared in shock, and now Carl turned and shouted at her.
No, Willie, no! He's a drug addict, Willie! Willie, do not listen, cried Carl. Shall I tell you where she lives, Willie? Do not listen, do not listen!
Carl was rushing Willie out of the room.
Go and visit her on Mother's Day, Willie! Surprise her! Go and...
Abruptly, the demon broke off its laughter and fixed its eyes on Karras. He had again checked Reagan's pulse, and finding it strong enough to give her more Librium, he was moving to Sharon to instruct her to prepare another injection.
Karras, do you want her? Leered the demon. She is yours. Yes, the stable whore is yours. You may ride her as you wish. Why, she fantasizes nightly concerning you, Karras. Yes, you and your long, thick, priestly cock.
Sharon crimsoned and kept her eyes averted, as Karras told her it was safe to give Reagan the Librium. And a Compazine suppository in case there's more vomiting, he added. Sharon nodded at the floor and started stiffly away. As she walked by the bed with her head still lowered, Reagan croaked at her,
Slut!
And then jerked up and hit her face with a flung bolt of vomit. And while Sharon stood paralyzed and in shock, the Dennings personality appeared, rasping,
Stable whore! Cunt!
Sharon bolted from the room. The Dennings personality now grimaced with distaste, glanced around and asked,
Would someone crack a window open, please? It bloody stinks in this room. It's simply,
No, for heaven's sake, don't. Someone else might wind up bloody well dead. And then it cackled, winking monstrously at Karras, and vanished.
It is he who expels you. Oh, does he, Marin? Does he?
The demonic entity had returned, and Marin continued the adjurations, the applications of the stole and the constant tracings of the sign of the cross, while the entity lashed him again obscenely. Too long, Karras worried.
The fit was continuing far too long.
Another sow comes, the mother of the piglet.
Karis turned and saw Chris coming toward him with a swab and a disposable syringe. She kept her head down as the demon hurled abuse, and Karis went to her frowning.
Sharon's changing her clothes, Chris explained, and Carl's...
Karis cut her short with a brusque, all right, and together they approached the bed.
Ah, yes. Come see your handiwork, sow mother. Come!
Chris tried not to listen, not to look, while Karis pinned Reagan's unresisting arms.
See the puke? See the murderous bitch? The demon raged. Are you pleased? It is you who has done it. Yes, you, with your career before anything. Your career before your husband, before her.
Karis glanced around. Chris stood paralyzed. Go ahead, he told her firmly. Don't listen. Go ahead.
Your divorce. Go to priests, will you? Priests will not help. Your piglet is mad. Don't you understand that? You've driven her to madness and to murder.
I can't. Face contorted, Chris was staring at the quivering syringe in her trembling hand, and she shook her head. I can't do it. Karis plucked the syringe from her fingers. All right, swab it. Swab the arm. Over here.
In her coffin, you bitch!
Don't listen, Karis cautioned Chris again. And at this, the demonic entity jerked its head around, its red-laced eyes bulging fury.
And you, Karis... Yes, about you!
Chris swabbed Reagan's arm. Now get out, Karis ordered her as he poked the hypodermic needle into wasted flesh. Chris fled from the room.
Yes, we know of your kindness to mothers, dear Karis, croaked the demon.
The Jesuit blenched, and for a moment did not move. Then slowly, he drew out the needle and looked into the whites of Reagan's eyes as out of her mouth came a slow, lilting singing in a sweet, clear voice like that of a very young choir boy.
Tantum ergo sacramentum veni remur cernui.
It was a hymn sung at Catholic benediction. Karis stood bloodlessly as it continued. Weird and chilling, the singing was a vacuum into which Karis felt the horror of the evening rushing with a horrible clarity. He looked up and saw Merrin with a towel in his hands. With weary, tender movements, he wiped away the vomit from Reagan's face and neck.
Et antiquum documentum